Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves. And I'm really excited for you guys to get a chance to listen to my guest today. This is Barb Jeunesse. She is the chair of the Newfoundland Club's Four-Limb Anomaly Committee. And the topic that we're talking about today is one that I think a lot of people don't know about. And I think the work that Barb's doing with her committee is pretty amazing. And I think you guys are going to be fascinated by it. So, Barb, welcome.
Thank you.
So give us a little bit of 411 about how you got involved in Newfoundlands and what brought you to this particular study.
I got my first Newfoundland in 1975 or 76. Mm. And I chose the breed because I had three very active boys. We lived in Hawaii. I wanted a dog that liked the water. I wanted a dog that my kids couldn't possibly hurt if they stepped on it, fell on it, or did something. And I wanted, number one was temperament. I wanted to make sure that when all the neighborhood kids were over, it was not something that I had to worry about, that the dog was going to be mean.
Right.
So that was what brought me to the breed. I picked out several breeds and then happened to see my first Newfoundland in the flesh and knew that's where I had to go. In Hawaii, we spent our days at the beach with our first Newfoundland and three young boys.
Sounds like a good time to me.
Then I ventured into obedience work, really because my first Newfoundland decided that nobody should be allowed in the water.
Oh my gosh.
And decided to rescue everyone, and I had zero control. So that's what brought me to obedience, which led to showing and then just an involvement with the Newfoundland Club of America. At a point, probably in the 80s, there were some litters born that had a kind of a, nobody knew what it was. And speaking with a very well-known breeder, she suggested that maybe I could help work with this since I was close to Michigan State at the time and their vet school. So that led me to working on this anomaly, basically. And what really piqued my interest is that I had a very well-known stud dog sire that won the National Specialty Best of Opposite 1 year. He did really well. And he had a brother who was affected with this problem. Yet he, as a stud dog, never produced it, but he had a get that did produce it. So just a lot of unknowns there that maybe I should look into this.
Right.
So that's kind of where I started.
Okay, so that's fascinating. And so describe what you're working on, this Newfoundland four-limb anomaly. Describe this particular disease process.
It's Newfoundland four-limb anomaly, and it just affects the four quarters or the four limbs of the dog. It does not affect the rear limbs in any way. And the elbows bow out, the pasterns bow out. To describe it, I would say you almost look like you're looking at a Basset Hound front or something like that. Some of the dogs that have that.
So is it a type of a dwarfism gene? Is that what you're thinking?
It is not dwarfism, but that's what it would look like.
Okay.
The dwarfism affects both front and rear legs.
Right.
Four-limb anomaly only seems to affect the front legs. So first of all, we refer to it as Newfoundland elbow anomaly, but realizing that it's not just the elbows, it's really the whole forelimb that is affected. So the name kind of changed to four-limb anomaly, and probably we should drop the Newfoundland title on it because there are other breeds that have now shown that they are affected. It is not something that you can pick out when they're born. And so it's not like you could have a litter and say, uh-oh, this dog has four-limb anomaly. Oftentimes, it is not recognized until 8, 10, 12 weeks. So these sometimes can be puppies that go on to new homes.
Before they realize,
yeah, there's really something wrong.
Wow.
Because it does get a little progressive in their, you know, they seem to have a somewhat normal front. And then through that juvenile period, it seems to get progressively worse. Until I think then it reaches a point where it is what it is, kind of.
Do the dogs then, do they live an adequate life or they're severely affected by it?
It depends. We know so little about this condition.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, there are dogs. I have seen dogs that have lived a reasonably normal life. they are not severely affected. Then I've seen dogs that when you see puppies that don't seem to want to get up and play, they just lay down all day. Yeah, there's a quality of life there.
Right.
And those dogs are probably in pain. It's just, I hate to hesitate, but we actually know so little about the disease.
Right.
Only that they are affected. There is limited mobility in those that are severely affected. Mm-hmm. They have difficulty going upstairs.
Okay.
That type of thing. A very strange gait in the front.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to throw their leg around rather than step forward. And it depends on the severity.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a bit earlier, and I know in speaking with our friend that set this up to have this conversation, there has been discussion of this in other breeds. Are you at liberty to discuss what those breeds are? I know she mentioned a Chow Chow, maybe?
There are other breeds. And partly what we have done is oftentimes this somebody in the middle of nowhere had a Newfoundland with a strange front, and their vet said, oh, that's retained cartilaginous cores or mm-hmm. some diagnosis. And somebody over here had a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody in the other side of the country had a dog affected. And these were all being misdiagnosed. So finally, one of the first things we did was to have one person look at these x-rays, like have a clearinghouse for this disease,
right.
Because it's not written up in books. They don't know a lot about it. So, you know, some vets would say, gee, I've never seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was either not getting diagnosed or misdiagnosed. So that was the first thing we did. And once we had somewhat of a clearinghouse, we do work with OFA, and we send the x-rays come through the committee and go off to OFA, where they look at them and determine whether or not this animal has foreleg anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
We also have two vets on our committee who look at the x-rays. This all helps to be able to properly diagnose the disease, because that's number one. Do they have it or don't they?
Right.
You know, you've got to have it properly diagnosed first. And in doing that, we have come across breeds, Tibetan Mastiffs, St. Bernards, Bernese Mountain Dogs, Nova Scotia Duck Tolling Dogs, Chesapeake Bay Retrievers. All of these dogs have either had an x-ray confirmed or are suspect.
Okay.
And an aside, I find it quite interesting that most of these breeds that have had it confirmed are, in fact, if you look back in their genetics,
right.
Tied to the Newfoundland in some way.
Right. I was just kind of running through and thinking maybe a progenitor of one of the Mastiff type breeds that was a progenitor behind all.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's just a casual observation,
right.
And it might not prove to be true. But for right now, it's interesting that many of these affected mm-hmm. dog breeds do have some sort of link to the Newfoundland,
right.
Be it through the Tibetan Mastiffs or whatever.
So then what exactly, I mean, you had to get word out about this within the membership of your club and the ownership of the breed as a whole, I would assume.
Yes, and we still work on that. That's still somewhat of an issue. And partly it's an issue because there's a lot of breeders that maybe are not actively involved with the Newfoundland club that might have a litter that's affected. And oftentimes they make an assumption that the dog was fed wrong. It's that the owner must have done something wrong.
Mm.
So it's hard because nobody wants to admit or come face to face with such a crippling disease. So we often have people that just can't seem to come to grips with this. And so we still have to fight getting the word out
mm-hmm.
and overcoming the stigma. And overcoming, you know, that somebody did something wrong and that's why this dog has a problem. And I think that's the biggest thing in any breed is overcoming the stigma that they would have produced it, because
mm-hmm.
that's just human nature.
Well, it is. And I think it's one of the things that organizations like CHIC, the Canine Health Information Centers, stuff like that, the idea of test and tell,
yeah.
right, and sharing information in breeding is so important. This is where I see the application across all breeds, right? Like the only way you can deal with something like this, no matter what it is, whether it's Newfoundland forelimb anomaly or the Spinoni guest that I had a year or two ago talking about the disease in her breed. So I think that that's really important that we keep that in mind as owners, as breeders, as exhibitors, as fanciers, that, you know, life happens, right? You know, it's
yeah.
important that we share the information and get rid of, as you say, the stigma.
I always tell people nobody produces a litter hoping that they have
right.
three elbow anomalies and two bad hearts
right.
and a couple of hip dysplasias. You know?
And welcome to being a dog breeder. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's like nobody starts out hoping right. for that. It's just how they deal with it, I think, that makes them a breeder.
Absolutely.
If they're willing to step forward and say there's a problem and we need to deal with it.
Right. And so you guys are making, okay, first question before I get there. Do you have a sense at all, just based on what information you've been able to compile to date, what kind of a percentage of the breed or numbers of the breed that are affected by this?
No. I would tell you the only thing we know for sure is that it is not a recessive trait, a genetic recessive trait.
Okay.
And we know that because back in the 80s, we actually bred two forelimb anomaly dogs to try and produce the problem, and mm-hmm. all the puppies were normal.
Interesting. Okay, so you have done some test breedings on this as well as collecting
yeah.
information for studies.
Yeah, way back in the 80s.
Wow.
Before a lot of genetic testing and that kind of stuff. And so that was done, and fortunately, all the dogs were born normal.
Right.
The only thing I can tell you we know for an absolute fact is that it is not a genetic recessive.
Okay. And so where are you now, and what are your future plans in terms of, are you collecting DNA along with these x-rays of confirmed cases and things like that?
Yes. Where we're at now is, unfortunately, because it seemed at first to be a Newfoundland problem, it was hard to get studies with large amounts of money that would focus just on one breed.
Mm-hmm.
Those studies usually are, if they can do multiple breeds, it's a little better. So we decided at least if we could have a clearinghouse and confirm cases and collect DNA, that we would have a repository of positive dogs that we would know, in hopes that we could find somebody willing to look at this.
Right.
Back in the 80s, Michigan State did some work on it. And then the two doctors there, one passed away and one retired. So those studies kind of fell by the wayside. We now have some studies that are ongoing, and some promising information is coming out. They just need more samples.
Mm-hmm.
So we are on a quest to get more samples and more x-rays and more confirmed cases. I just got interesting information yesterday regarding this, that they have done some DNA analysis on these, and there's information that is very helpful going forward. So there's hope, I guess, on the
mm-hmm.
horizon.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be easy because this disease is going to, I would say, prove to be multigenetic. I think, and this is just an observation, that what we're dealing with is multi-genes, and there's some sort of trigger that turns them on or off.
Right, which they talk about that a lot in various and sundry things. And so then the goal gets to be to find the gene and also to find the trigger, right?
Yeah, because we have litters. We had a litter last year, 8 puppies born, 7 were affected.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, which was crazy. Then we have litters where 8 puppies and 1 is affected.
Mm.
So we have it on all spectrums, all
mm-hmm.
across. So if you tally up all of that, we don't have a clear picture.
But you are working with OFA and with specific
yes.
researchers in order to acquire more information
yes.
and information that's going to be applicable across a number of breeds from the sounds of it.
Yes. Yes, it will be. It's like any of these diseases. You find it first in
mm-hmm.
one breed, maybe, and then you can grow from there.
Mm-hmm. Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons-only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, Laura at puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details. Some of the study that I've talked to people, the epigenetics, the piece about the turn it on and off, you know, that kind of thing, is
yeah.
just fascinating. And we are learning more and more and more all the time. So,
yes. And that's it. I think when I look back when we started in the 80s, and we didn't know anything, and we had to resort to a test breeding, you know, and now we have such wonderful DNA analysis and things like that are only going to help us. It's just up to us to keep collecting that data and that information, and to also make sure that breeders come forward with a litter. More likely, I get a call from an owner that says, there's something really funny with my puppy. And I think that it looks like what I see on the website, and I think my puppy might be affected. Then I have to go and, you know, ask them to get x-rays, et cetera. And then they have to talk to their breeder who, as I said, many breeders oftentimes say, no, that couldn't possibly be what it is. It takes them a few weeks to come around.
Wrap their heads around that. Well, like you say, it's an odd man out.
Yeah.
It's an outlier in terms of things within the breed to be worried about. And I think it sounds to me like the work you guys are doing is pretty valuable in gathering that information. So you have a link on the Newfoundland Club of America website, is that correct, that I can send people to?
We actually have a website, Newfoundland for Live Anomaly.
Okay.
And it has all the pictures and information and a way to connect to us if they feel like they do have a dog that's affected.
Great. Now I will make sure that link, you can send it to me. I'll make sure that link is put in the blog post that people can find on our website as well.
Yes, and that's critical to getting the word out and helping people with these animals and giving them some hope maybe and talking to them. Sometimes we're just like a Dear Abby.
Right.
You know, it's hard because the decisions they have to make can be difficult.
And is there, kind of as a final closing, is there any kind of treatment for a dog with this particular condition?
I think that's probably the hardest thing. And I think a lot of it depends on the individual dog and the severity and quality of life. And, you know, those are personal decisions that people have to make, and they have to take everything into account. What the dog will be expected to do, you know, stair climbing, they've got bunches of kids to play with. Can they stand up to the rigors? Are they in pain? And Newfoundlands tend to be somewhat of a stoic breed.
I was
going to
say,
anyway.
Super stoic, right?
Yeah. Oftentimes, you know, an owner will say to me, well, is she in pain? And, you know, I don't know. You know, I have seen some puppies through the years because I was responsible for transporting a lot of these puppies to Michigan State for x-rays that, yeah, I think they were in pain. And I've seen others that seem to adapt to their disability. So it's such an individual thing. But surgeries have been proposed, and quite honestly, I'm not sure that surgery has given any of these dogs more mobility or anything other than a lot of years of surgeries. Sometimes they happen to go through two or three surgeries. So I'm going to tell you that, yeah, I'm not sure surgery is the answer. Keeping them thin is certainly the best thing. And exercised according to their tolerance, I think, is good. You know, a lower protein dog food, because you don't want rapid growth in that puppy with a forelimb problem. So those are really the only things we can do. And then, you know, in all honesty, euthanasia is an option. You know, I hate to say euthanasia is a treatment option, but it depends on the severity and the pain levels of that animal.
Sure, absolutely. Okay, so the most important thing that people can do is send you x-rays, contact you if they have a questionable dog, share DNA, share pedigrees, do that kind of crowdsourcing of knowledge that's going to help you guys succeed, right?
Yes.
Is there any kind of a fundraising opportunity, or, you know, are you looking for people to contribute to the science, if you will?
There might be one coming up. As I mentioned, some new information that I was just told about in the last couple of days, they're looking to raise some money to further this research. So we're just really discussing that now. So there might be some fundraising in the future.
Okay. And the information about that would be available on the website that we're going to link. Okay.
Yes.
Very good. Excellent. Well, Barb, thank you so much for your time and for your work on this. This sounds like kind of a lifetime dedication to this project. So thank you for that from all of us that have purebred dogs.
Well, thank you.
You have a great day, and we'll hope for the best for your projects.
Thanks a lot.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.